Ohio, said there was scarcely a political observer, but will admit that there were an election to come now, a mighty tide of socialism would inundate the Middle West. It said the country had never embarked upon a more unpopular war. In the municipal elections of 1917, against the tide of propaganda and patriotism, the socialists made remarkable gains. Their candidate for mayor of New York, Morris Hillquit, got 22% of the vote, 5 times the normal socialist vote there. 10 socialists were elected to the New York State Legislature. In Chicago, the party vote went from 3.6% in 1915 to 34.7% in 1917. In Buffalo, it went from 2.6% to 30.2%. George Creel and the government were behind the formation of an American Alliance for Labor and Democracy, whose president was Samuel Gompers, and whose aim was to unify sentiment in the nation for the war. There were branches in 164 cities. Many labor leaders went along. According to James Weinstein, however, the alliance did not work. Rank-and-file working-class support for the war remained lukewarm. And although some prominent socialists, Jack London, Upton Sinclair, Clarence Darrow, became pro-war after the U.S. entered, most socialists continued their opposition. Congress passed and Wilson signed, in June of 1917, the Espionage Act. From its title, one would suppose it was an act against spying. However, it had a clause that provided penalties of up to 20 years in prison for whoever, when the United States is at war, shall willfully cause or attempt to cause insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, or refusal of duty in the military or naval forces of the United States, or shall willfully obstruct the recruiting or enlistment service of the U.S. Unless one had a theory about the nature of governments, it was not clear how the Espionage Act would be used. It even had a clause that said, "Nothing in this section shall be construed to limit or restrict any discussion, comment, or criticism of the acts or policies of the government." But its double talk concealed a singleness of purpose. The Espionage Act was used to imprison Americans who spoke or wrote against the war. 2 months after the law passed, a socialist named Charles Schenck was arrested in Philadelphia for printing and distributing 15,000 leaflets that denounced the draft law and the war. The leaflet recited the 13th Amendment provision against involuntary servitude and said the Conscription Act violated this. Conscription, it said, was a monstrous deed against humanity in the interests of the financiers of Wall Street, and do not submit to intimidation. Schenck was indicted, tried, found guilty, and sentenced to 6 months in jail for violating the Espionage Act. It turned out to be one of the shortest sentences given in such cases. Schenck appealed, arguing that the act, by prosecuting speech and writing, violated the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. The Supreme Court's decision was unanimous and was written by its most famous liberal, Oliver Wendell Holmes. He summarized the contents of the leaflet and said it was undoubtedly intended to obstruct the carrying out of the draft law. Was Schenck protected by the First Amendment? Holmes said, "The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing panic. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent." Holmes' analogy was clever and attractive. Few people would think free speech should be conferred on someone shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. But did that example fit criticism of the war? Zechariah Chaffee, a Harvard Law School professor, wrote later, free speech in the United States, that a more apt analogy for Schenck was someone getting up between the acts at a theater and declaring that there were not enough fire exits. To play further with the example, was not Schenck's act more like someone shouting, not falsely but truly, to people about to buy tickets and enter a theater, that there was a fire raging inside? Perhaps free speech could not be tolerated by any reasonable person if it constituted a clear and present danger to life and liberty. After all, free speech must compete with other vital rights. But was not the war itself a clear and present danger? Indeed, more clear and more present and more dangerous to life than any argument against it? Did citizens not have a right to object to war, a right to be a danger to dangerous policies? The Espionage Act, thus approved by the Supreme Court, has remained on the books all these years since World War I, and although it is supposed to apply only in wartime, it has been constantly enforced since 1950, because the United States has legally been in a state of emergency since the Korean War. In 1963, the Kennedy administration pushed a bill, unsuccessfully, to apply the Espionage Act to statements uttered by Americans abroad. It was concerned, in the words of a cable from Secretary of State Rusk to Ambassador Lodge in Vietnam, about journalists in Vietnam writing critical articles on Diem and his government that were likely to impede the war effort. The case of Eugene Debs soon came before the Supreme Court. In June of 1918, Debs visited three socialists who were in prison for opposing the draft, and then spoke across the street from the jail to an audience he kept enthralled for 2 hours. He was one of the country's great orators, and was interrupted again and again by laughter and applause. "Why, the other day, by a vote of 5-4, a kind of craps game, come 7, come 11, they declared the child labor law unconstitutional." He spoke of his comrades in jail. He dealt with the charges that socialists were pro-German. "I hate, I loathe, I despise junkers and junkerdom. I have no earthly use for the junkers of Germany, and not one particle more use for the junkers in the United States." Thunderous applause and cheers. "They tell us that we live in a great free republic, that our institutions are democratic, that we are a free and self-governing people. That is too much even for a joke. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder, and that is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles." Debs was arrested for violating the Espionage Act. There were draft-age youths in his audience, and his words would obstruct the recruiting or enlistment service. His words were intended to do much more than that. "Yes, in good time we are going to sweep into power in this nation and throughout the world. We are going to destroy all enslaving and degrading capitalist institutions and recreate them as free and humanizing institutions. The world is daily changing before our eyes. The sun of capitalism is setting. The sun of socialism is rising. In due time, the hour will strike, and this great cause triumphant will proclaim the emancipation of the working class and the brotherhood of all mankind." Thunderous and prolonged applause. Debs refused at his trial to take the stand in his defense or to call witnesses on his behalf. He denied nothing about what he said. But before the jury began its deliberations, he spoke to them. "I have been accused of obstructing the war. I admit it. Gentlemen, I abhor war. I would oppose war if I stood alone. I have sympathy with the suffering, struggling people everywhere. It does not make any difference under what flag they were born or where they live." The jury found him guilty of violating the Espionage Act. Debs addressed the judge before sentencing. "Your Honor, years ago I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. The judge denounced those who would strike the sword from the hand of this nation while she is engaged in defending herself against a foreign and brutal power. He sentenced Debs to 10 years in prison. Debs' appeal was not heard by the Supreme Court until 1919. The war was over. Oliver Wendell Holmes, for a unanimous court, affirmed Debs' guilt. Holmes discussed Debs' speech. He then expressed opposition to Prussian militarism in a way that naturally might have been thought to be intended to include the mode of proceeding here in the United States. Holmes said Debs made the usual contrasts between capitalists and laboring men, with the implication running through it all that the working men are not concerned in the war. Thus, Holmes said, the natural and intended effect of Debs' speech would be to obstruct recruiting. Debs was locked up in the West Virginia State Penitentiary and then in the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, where he spent 32 months until, at the age of 66, he was released by President Harding in 1921. About 900 people went to prison under the Espionage Act. This substantial opposition was put out of sight, while the visible national mood was represented by military bands, flag-waving, the mass buying of war bonds, the majority's acquiescence to the draft and the war. This acquiescence was achieved by shrewd public relations and by intimidation, an effort organized with all the power of the federal government and the money of big business behind it. The magnitude of that campaign to discourage opposition says something about the spontaneous feelings of the population toward the war. The newspapers helped create an atmosphere of fear for possible opponents of the war. In April of 1917, the New York Times quoted Elihu Root, former Secretary of War, a corporation lawyer, as saying, "We must have no criticism now." A few months later, it quoted him again that, "There are men walking about the streets of this city tonight who ought to be taken out at sunrise tomorrow and shot for treason." At the same time, Theodore Roosevelt was talking to the Harvard Club about socialists, IWWs, and others who wanted peace as a whole raft of sexless creatures. In the summer of 1917, the American Defense Society was formed. The New York Herald reported, "More than 100 men enrolled yesterday in the American Vigilante Patrol at the offices of the American Defense Society. The patrol was formed to put an end to seditious street oratory." The Department of Justice sponsored an American Protective League, which by June of 1917 had units in 600 cities and towns, a membership of nearly 100,000. The press reported that their members were the leading men in their communities, bankers, railroad men, hotel men. One study of the League describes their methods. "The males are supposed to be sacred, but let us call the American Protective League sometimes almost clairvoyant as to letters done by suspects. It is supposed that breaking and entering a man's home or office place without warrants is burglary. Granted. But the League has done that thousands of times and has never been detected." The League claimed to have found 3 million cases of disloyalty. Even if these figures are exaggerated, the very size and scope of the League gives a clue to the amount of disloyalty. The states organized vigilante groups. The Minnesota Commission of Public Safety, set up by state law, closed saloons and moving picture theaters, took count of land owned by aliens, boosted liberty bonds, tested people for loyalty. The Minneapolis Journal carried an appeal by the commission for all patriots to join in the suppression of anti-draft and seditious acts and sentiment. The national press cooperated with the government. The New York Times in the summer of 1917 carried an editorial. It is the duty of every good citizen to communicate to proper authorities any evidence of sedition that comes to his notice. And the Literary Digest asked its readers to clip and send to us any editorial utterances they encounter which seem to them seditious or treasonable. Creel's Committee on Public Information advertised that people should report the man who spreads pessimistic stories, report him to the Department of Justice. In 1918, the Attorney General said, "It is safe to say that never in its history has this country been so thoroughly policed." Why these huge efforts? On August 1, 1917, the New York Herald reported that in New York City, 90 of the first 100 draftees claimed exemption. In Minnesota, headlines in the Minneapolis Journal of August 6 and 7 read, "Draft opposition fast spreading in state," and "Conscripts give false addresses." In Florida, two Negro farmhands went into the woods with a shotgun and mutilated themselves to avoid the draft. One blew off 4 fingers of his hand. The other shot off his arm below the elbow. Senator Thomas Hardwick of Georgia said, "There was undoubtedly general and widespread opposition on the part of many thousands to the enactment of the draft law. Numerous and largely attended mass meetings held in every part of the state protested against it." Ultimately, over 330,000 men were classified as draft evaders. In Oklahoma, the Socialist Party and the IWW had been active among tenant farmers and sharecroppers who formed a working-class union. At a mass meeting of the union, plans were made to destroy a railroad bridge and cut telegraph wires in order to block military enlistments. A march on Washington was planned for draft objectors throughout the country. This was called the Green Corn Rebellion because they planned to eat green corn on their march. Before the union could carry out its plans, its members were rounded up and arrested, and soon 450 individuals accused of rebellion were in the state penitentiary. Leaders were given 3 to 10 years in jail, others 60 days to 2 years. On July 1, 1917, radicals organized a parade in Boston against the war with banners. "Is this a popular war? Why conscription? Who stole Panama? Who crushed Haiti? We demand peace." The New York Call said 8,000 people marched, including 4,000 members of the Central Labor Union, 2,000 members of the Lettish Socialist Organizations, 1,500 Lithuanians, Jewish members of cloak trades, and other branches of the party. The parade was attacked by soldiers and sailors on orders from their officers. The Post Office Department began taking away the mailing privileges of newspapers and magazines that printed anti-war articles. The Masses, a socialist magazine of politics, literature, and art, was banned from the mails. It had carried an editorial by Max Eastman in the summer of 1917 saying, among other things, "For what specific purposes are you shipping our bodies and the bodies of our sons to Europe? For my part, I do not recognize the right of a government to draft me to a war whose purposes I do not believe in." In Los Angeles, a film was shown that dealt with the American Revolution and depicted British atrocities against the colonists. It was called The Spirit of 76. The man who made the film was prosecuted under the Espionage Act because the judge said the film tended to question the good faith of our ally, Great Britain. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison. The case was officially listed as U.S. versus Spirit of 76. In a small town in South Dakota, a farmer and socialist named Fred Fairchild, during an argument about the war, said, according to his accusers, "If I were of conscription age and had no dependents and were drafted, I would refuse to serve. They could shoot me, but they could not make me fight." He was tried under the Espionage Act, sentenced to a year and a day at Leavenworth Penitentiary. And so it went, multiplied 2,000 times the number of prosecutions under the Espionage Act. About 65,000 men declare themselves conscientious objectors and ask for noncombatant service. At the army bases where they worked, they were often treated with sadistic brutality. Three men who were jailed at Fort Riley, Kansas, for refusing to perform any military duties, combatant or noncombatant, were taken one by one into the corridor and a hemp rope slung over the railing of the upper tier was put about their necks, hoisting them off their feet until they were at the point of collapse. Meanwhile, the officers punched them on their ankles and shins. They were then lowered and the rope was tied to their arms, and again they were hoisted off their feet. This time a garden hose was played on their faces with a nozzle about 6 inches from them until they collapsed completely. Schools and universities discouraged opposition to the war. At Columbia University, J. McKean Cattell, a psychologist, a longtime critic of the Board of Trustees' control of the university, and an opponent of the war, was fired. A week later in protest, the famous historian Charles Beard resigned from the Columbia faculty, charging the trustees with being reactionary and visionless in politics, narrow and medieval in religion. In Congress, a few voices spoke out against the war. The first woman in the House of Representatives, Jeanette Rankin, did not respond when her name was called in the roll call on the declaration of war. One of the veteran politicians of the House, a supporter of the war, went to her and whispered, "Little woman, you cannot afford not to vote. You represent the womanhood of the country." On the next roll call, she stood up. "I want to stand by my country, but I cannot vote for war. I vote no." A popular song of the time was, "I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier." It was overwhelmed, however, by songs like "Over There," "It's a Grand Old Flag," and "Johnny Get Your Gun." Socialist Kate Richards O'Hare, speaking in North Dakota in July of 1917, said, it was reported, that the women of the United States were nothing more nor less than brood sows to raise children to get into the army and be made into fertilizer. She was arrested, tried, found guilty, and sentenced to 5 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary. In prison, she continued to fight. When she and fellow prisoners protested the lack of air because the window above the cell block was kept shut, she was pulled out in the corridor by guards for punishment. In her hand, she was carrying a book of poems, and as she was dragged out, she flung the book up at the window and broke it, the fresh air streaming in, her fellow prisoners cheering. Emma Goldman and her fellow anarchist, Alexander Berkman, he had already been locked up 14 years in Pennsylvania, she had served a year on Blackwell's Island, were sentenced to prison for opposing the draft. She spoke to the jury. "Verily, poor as we are in democracy, how can we give of it to the world? A democracy conceived in the military servitude of the masses, in their economic enslavement and nurtured in their tears and blood, is not democracy at all. It is despotism, the cumulative result of a chain of abuses which, according to that dangerous document, the Declaration of Independence, the people have the right to overthrow." The war gave the government its opportunity to destroy the IWW. The IWW newspaper, The Industrial Worker, just before the declaration of war, wrote, "Capitalists of America, we will fight against you, not for you. Conscription, there is not a power in the world that can make the working class fight if they refuse." Philip Foner, in his History of the IWW, says that the Wobblies were not as active against the war as the socialists, perhaps because they were fatalistic, saw the war as inevitable, and thought that only victory in class struggle, only revolutionary change could end war. In early September 1917, Department of Justice agents made simultaneous raids on 48 IWW meeting halls across the country, seizing correspondence and literature that would become courtroom evidence. Later that month, 165 IWW leaders were arrested for conspiring to hinder the draft, encourage desertion, and intimidate others in connection with labor disputes. 101 went on trial in April 1918. It lasted 5 months, the longest criminal trial in American history up to that time. John Reed, the socialist writer just back from reporting on the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, 10 days that shook the world, covered the IWW trial for The Masses magazine and described the defendants. I doubt if ever in history there has been a sight just like them. 101 lumberjacks, harvest hands, miners, editors, who believe the wealth of the world belongs to him who creates it, the outdoor men, hard rock blasters, tree fellers, wheat binders, longshoremen, the boys who do the strong work of the world. The IWW people used the trial to tell about their activities, their ideas. 61 of them took the stand, including Big Bill Haywood, who testified for 3 days. One IWW man told the court, "You ask me why the IWW is not patriotic to the United States. If you were a bum without a blanket, if you had left your wife and kids when you went west for a job and had never located them since, if your job had never kept you long enough in a place to qualify you to vote, if you slept in a lousy, sour bunkhouse and ate food just as rotten as they could give you and get by with it, if deputy sheriffs shot your cooking cans full of holes and spilled your grub on the ground, if your wages were lowered on you when the bosses thought they had you down, if there was one law for Ford, Sewer, and Mooney and another for Harry Thaw, if every person who represented law and order and the nation beat you up, railroaded you to jail, and the good Christian people cheered and told them to go to it, how in hell do you expect a man to be patriotic? This war is a businessman's war, and we don't see why we should go out and get shot in order to save the lovely state of affairs that we now enjoy." The jury found them all guilty. The judge sentenced Haywood and 14 others to 20 years in prison. 33 were given 10 years, the rest shorter sentences. They were fined a total of $2,500,000. The IWW was shattered. Haywood jumped bail and fled to revolutionary Russia, where he remained until his death 10 years later. The war ended in November 1918. 50,000 American soldiers had died, and it did not take long, even in the case of patriots, for bitterness and disillusionment to spread through the country. This was reflected in the literature of the post-war decade. John Dos Passos, in his novel 1919, wrote of the death of John Doe. "In the tar paper morgue at Chalons-sur-Marne, in the reek of chloride, of lime and the dead, they picked out the pine box that held all that was left of John Doe, the scraps of dried viscera and skin bundled in khaki. They took to Chalons-sur-Marne, and laid it out neat in a pine coffin, and took it home to God's country on a battleship, and buried it in a sarcophagus in the memorial amphitheater in the Arlington National Cemetery, and draped the Old Glory over it, and the bugler played taps. And Mr. Harding prayed to God, and the diplomats, and the generals, and the admirals, and the brass hats, and the politicians, and the handsomely dressed ladies out of the society column of the Washington Post stood up solemn, and thought how beautiful, sad, Old Glory, God's country it was to have the bugler play taps, and the three volleys made their ears ring. Where his chest ought to have been, they pinned the Congressional Medal." Ernest Hemingway would write A Farewell to Arms. Years later, a college student named Irwin Shaw would write a play, Bury the Dead. And a Hollywood screenwriter named Dalton Trumbo would write a powerful and chilling anti-war novel about a torso and brain left alive on the battlefield of World War I, Johnny Got His Gun. Ford Madox Ford wrote, No More Parades. With all the wartime jailings, the intimidation, the drive for national unity, when the war was over, the establishment still feared socialism. There seemed to be a need again for the twin tactics of control in the face of revolutionary challenge, reform and repression. The first was suggested by George L. Record, one of Wilson's friends, who wrote to him in early 1919 that something would have to be done for economic democracy to meet this menace of socialism. He said, "You should become the real leader of the radical forces in America and present to the country a constructive program of fundamental reform which shall be an alternative to the program represented by the socialists and the Bolsheviks." That summer of 1919, Wilson's advisor, Joseph Tumulty, reminded him that the conflict between the Republicans and Democrats was unimportant compared with that which threatened them both. What happened in Washington last night in the attempt upon the Attorney General's life is but a symptom of the terrible unrest that is stalking about the country. As a Democrat, I would be disappointed to see the Republican Party regain power. That is not what depresses one so much as to see, growing steadily from day to day, under our very eyes, a movement that, if not checked, is bound to express itself in attack upon everything we hold dear. In this era of industrial and social unrest, both parties are in disrepute with the average man. What happened in Washington last night was the explosion of a bomb in front of the home of Wilson's Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer. 6 months after that bomb exploded, Palmer carried out the first of his mass raids on aliens, immigrants who were not citizens. A law passed by Congress near the end of the war provided for the deportation of aliens who opposed organized government or advocated the destruction of property. Palmer's men, on December 21, 1919, picked up 249 aliens of Russian birth, including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, put them on a transport, and deported them to what had become Soviet Russia. The Constitution gave no right to Congress to deport aliens, but the Supreme Court had said back in 1892, in affirming the right of Congress to exclude Chinese, that as a matter of self-preservation, this was a natural right of the government. In January 1920, 4,000 persons were rounded up all over the country, held in seclusion for long periods of time, brought into secret hearings and ordered deported. In Boston, Department of Justice agents, aided by local police, arrested 600 people by raiding meeting halls or by invading their homes in the early morning. A troubled federal judge described the process. Pains were given to give spectacular publicity to the raid and to make it appear that there was a great and imminent public danger. The arrested aliens, in most instances, perfectly quiet and harmless working people, many of them not long ago Russian peasants, were handcuffed in pairs and then, for the purposes of transfer on trains and through the streets of Boston, chained together. In the spring of 1920, a typesetter and anarchist named Andrea Salcedo was arrested in New York by FBI agents and held for 8 weeks in the FBI offices on the 14th floor of the Park Row building, not allowed to contact family or friends or lawyers. Then his crushed body was found on the pavement below the building, and the FBI said he had committed suicide by jumping from the 14th floor window. Two friends of Salcedo, anarchists and working men in the Boston area, having just learned of his death, began carrying guns. They were arrested on a streetcar in Brockton, Massachusetts, and charged with a holdup and murder that had taken place 2 weeks before at a shoe factory. These were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. They went on trial, were found guilty, and spent 7 years in jail while appeals went on, and while all over the country and the world, people became involved in their case. The trial record and the surrounding circumstances suggested that Sacco and Vanzetti were sentenced to death because they were anarchists and foreigners. In August 1927, as police broke up marches and picket lines with arrests and beatings, and troops surrounded the prison, they were electrocuted. Sacco's last message to his son Dante, in his painfully learned English, was a message to millions of others in the years to come. So, son, instead of crying, be strong so as to be able to comfort your mother. Take her for a long walk in the quiet country, gathering wild flowers here and there. But remember always, Dante, in the play of happiness, don't you use all for yourself only. Help the persecuted and the victim, because they are your better friends. In this struggle of life, you will find more, and love, and you will be loved. There had been reforms. The patriotic fervor had been invoked. The courts and jails had been used to reinforce the idea that certain ideas, certain kinds of resistance, could not be tolerated. And still, even from the cells of the condemned, the message was going out. The class war was still on in that supposedly classless society, the United States. Through the 20s and the 30s, it was still on. Chapter 15, Self-Help in Hard Times. The war was hardly over. It was February 1919. The IWW leadership was in jail. But the IWW idea of the general strike became reality for 5 days in Seattle, Washington, when a walkout of 100,000 working people brought the city to a halt. It began with 35,000 shipyard workers striking for a wage increase. They appealed for support to the Seattle Central Labor Council, which recommended a citywide strike, and in 2 weeks, 110 locals, mostly American Federation of Labor, only a few IWW, voted to strike. The rank and file of each striking local elected 3 members to a general strike committee, and on February 6, 1919, at 10 a.m., the strike began. Unity was not easy to achieve. The IWW locals were in tension with the AFL locals. Japanese locals were admitted to the general strike committee, but were not given a vote. Still, 60,000 union members were out, and 40,000 other workers joined in sympathy. Seattle workers had a radical tradition. During the war, the president of the Seattle AFL, a socialist, was imprisoned for opposing the draft, was tortured, and there were great labor rallies in the streets to protest. The city now stopped functioning, except for activities organized by the strikers to provide essential needs. Firemen agreed to stay on the job. Laundry workers handled only hospital laundry. Vehicles authorized to move carried signs, exempted by the General Strike Committee. 35 neighborhood milk stations were set up. Every day, 30,000 meals were prepared in large kitchens, then transported to halls all over the city and served cafeteria-style, with strikers paying 25 cents a meal, the general public 35 cents. People were allowed to eat as much as they wanted of the beef stew, spaghetti, bread and coffee. A labor war veterans guard was organized to keep the peace. On the blackboard at one of its headquarters was written, "The purpose of this organization is to preserve law and order without the use of force. No volunteer will have any police power or be allowed to carry weapons of any sort, but to use persuasion only." During the strike, crime in the city decreased. The commander of the U.S. Army detachment sent into the area told the strikers' committee that in 40 years of military experience, he hadn't seen so quiet and orderly a city. A poem printed in the Seattle Union Record, a daily newspaper put out by labor people, by someone named Anise. "What scares them most is that nothing happens. They are ready for disturbances. They have machine guns and soldiers, but this smiling silence is uncanny. The businessmen don't understand that sort of weapon. It is your smile that is upsetting. their reliance on artillery, brother. It is the garbage wagons that go along the street marked exempt by strike committee. It is the milk stations that are getting better daily. And the 300 war veterans of labor handling the crowds without guns. For these things speak of a new power and a new world that they do not feel at home in. The mayor swore in 2,400 special deputies, many of them students at the University of Washington. Almost 1,000 sailors and Marines were brought into the city by the U.S. government. The general strike ended after 5 days, according to the General Strike Committee, because of pressure from the international officers of the various unions, as well as the difficulties of living in a shut-down city. The strike had been peaceful, but when it was over, there were raids and arrests on the Socialist Party headquarters, on a printing plant. 39 members of the IWW were jailed as ringleaders of anarchy. In Centralia, Washington, where the IWW had been organizing lumber workers, the lumber interests made plans to get rid of the IWW. On November 11, 1919, Armistice Day, the Legion paraded through town with rubber hoses and gas pipes, and the IWW prepared for an attack. When the Legion passed the IWW hall, shots were fired. It is unclear who fired first. They stormed the hall. There was more firing, and 3 Legion men were killed. Inside the headquarters was an IWW member, a lumberjack named Frank Everett, who had been in France as a soldier while the IWW national leaders were on trial for obstructing the war effort. Everett was in army uniform and carrying a rifle. He emptied it into the crowd, dropped it, and ran for the woods, followed by a mob. He started to wade across the river, found the current too strong, turned, shot the leading man dead, threw his gun into the river, and fought the mob with his fists. They dragged him back to town behind an automobile, suspended him from a telegraph pole, took him down, locked him in jail. That night, his jailhouse door was broken down, he was dragged out, put on the floor of a car, his genitals were cut off, and then he was taken to a bridge, hanged, and his body riddled with bullets. No one was ever arrested for Everett's murder, but 11 Wobblies were put on trial for killing an American Legion leader during the parade, and 6 of them spent 15 years in prison. Why such a reaction to the general strike, to the organizing of the Wobblies? A statement by the mayor of Seattle suggests that the establishment feared not just the strike itself, but what it symbolized. He said, "The so-called sympathetic Seattle strike was an attempted revolution. That there was no violence does not alter the fact. The intent, openly and covertly announced, was for the overthrow of the industrial system. Here first, then everywhere. True, there were no flashing guns, no bombs, no killings. Revolution, I repeat, doesn't need violence. The general strike, as practiced in Seattle, is of itself the weapon of revolution, all the more dangerous because quiet. To succeed, it must suspend everything, stop the entire life stream of a community. That is to say, it puts the government out of operation. And that is all there is to revolt, no matter how achieved." Furthermore, the Seattle general strike took place in the midst of a wave of post-war rebellion all over the world. A writer in The Nation commented that year, "The most extraordinary phenomenon of the present time is the unprecedented revolt of the rank and file. In Russia, it has dethroned the Tsar. In Korea and India and Egypt and Ireland, it keeps up an unyielding resistance to political tyranny. In England, it brought about the railway strike against the judgment of the men's own executives. In Seattle and San Francisco, it has resulted in the stevedore's recent refusal to handle arms or supplies destined for the overthrow of the Soviet government. In one district of Illinois, it manifested itself in a resolution of striking miners, unanimously requesting their state executive to go to hell. In Pittsburgh, according to Mr. Gompers, it compelled the reluctant American Federation officers to call the steel strike, lest the control pass into the hands of the IWWs and other radicals. In New York, it brought about the longshoremen strike and kept the men out in defiance of union officials, and caused the upheaval in the printing trade, which the international officers, even though the employers worked hand in glove with them, were completely unable to control. The common man, losing faith in the old leadership, has experienced a new access of self-confidence, or at least a new recklessness, a readiness to take chances on his own account. Authority cannot any longer be imposed from above. It comes automatically from below. In the steel mills of western Pennsylvania, later in 1919, where men worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, doing exhausting work under intense heat, 100,000 steel workers were signed up in 20 different AFL craft unions. A national committee attempting to tie them together in their organizing drive found in the summer of 1919, "The men are letting it be known that if we do not do something for them, they will take the matter into their own hands." The National Council was getting telegrams like the one from the Johnstown Steelworkers Council. "Unless the National Committee authorizes a national strike vote to be taken this week, we will be compelled to go out on strike here alone." William Z. Foster, later a communist leader, at this time secretary-treasurer to the National Committee in charge of organizing, received a telegram from organizers in the Youngstown district. "We cannot be expected to meet the enraged workers who will consider us traitors if strike is postponed." There was pressure from President Woodrow Wilson and Samuel Gompers, AFL president, to postpone the strike. But the steelworkers were too insistent, and in September 1919, not only the 100,000 union men, but 250,000 others went out on strike. The sheriff of Allegheny County swore in as deputies 5,000 employees of U.S. Steel who had not gone on strike, and announced that outdoor meetings would be forbidden. A report of the Interchurch World Movement made at the time said, "In Monessen, the policy of the state police was simply to club men off the streets and drive them into their homes. In Braddock, when a striker was clubbed in the street, he would be taken to jail, kept there overnight. Many of those arrested in Newcastle were ordered not to be released until the strike was over." The Department of Justice moved in, carrying out raids on workers who were aliens, holding them for deportation. At Gary, Indiana, federal troops were sent in. Other factors operated against the strikers. Most were recent immigrants of many nationalities, many languages. Sherman Service Incorporated, hired by the steel corporations to break the strike, instructed its men in South Chicago, "We want you to stir up as much bad feeling as you possibly can between the Serbians and the Italians. Spread data among the Serbians that the Italians are going back to work. Urge them to go back to work or the Italians will get their jobs." More than 30,000 black workers were brought into the area as strikebreakers. They had been excluded from AFL unions and so felt no loyalty to unionism. As the strike dragged on, the mood of defeat spread and workers began to drift back to work. After 10 weeks, the number of strikers was down to 110,000, and then the National Committee called the strike off. In the year following the war, 120,000 textile workers struck in New England and New Jersey, and 30,000 silk workers struck in Paterson, New Jersey. In Boston, the police went out on strike, and in New York City, cigar makers, shirt makers, carpenters, bakers, teamsters, and barbers were out on strike. In Chicago, the press reported, "More strikes and lockouts accompany the midsummer heat than ever known before at any one time. 5,000 workers at International Harvester and 5,000 city workers were in the streets." When the 20s began, however, the situation seemed under control. The IWW was destroyed, the Socialist Party falling apart, The strikes were beaten down by force, and the economy was doing just well enough for just enough people to prevent mass rebellion. Congress in the 20s put an end to the dangerous, turbulent flood of immigrants, 14 million between 1900 and 1920, by passing laws setting immigration quotas. The quotas favored Anglo-Saxons, kept out black and yellow people, limited severely the coming of Latins, Slavs, Jews. No African country could send more than 100 people. 100 was the limit for China, for Bulgaria, for Palestine. 34,007 could come from England or Northern Ireland, but only 3,845 from Italy. 51,227 from Germany, but only 124 from Lithuania. 28,567 from the Irish Free State, but only 2,248 from Russia. The Ku Klux Klan was revived in the 1920s, and it spread into the North. By 1924, it had 4.5 million members. The NAACP seemed helpless in the face of mob violence and race hatred everywhere. The impossibility of the black person's ever being considered equal in white America was the theme of the nationalist movement led in the 1920s by Marcus Garvey. He preached black pride, racial separation, and a return to Africa, which to him held the only hope for black unity and survival. But Garvey's movement, inspiring as it was to some blacks, could not make much headway against the powerful white supremacy currents of the post-war decade. There was some truth to the standard picture of the 20s as a time of prosperity and fun. The jazz age, the roaring 20s. Unemployment was down from 4,270,000 in 1921 to a little over 2 million in 1927. The general level of wages for workers rose. Some farmers made a lot of money. The 40% of all families who made over $2,000 a year could buy new gadgets, autos, radios, refrigerators. Millions of people were not doing badly, and they could shut out of the picture the others, the tenant farmers, black and white, the immigrant families in the big cities, either without work or not making enough to get the basic necessities. But prosperity was concentrated at the top. While from 1922 to 1929, real wages in manufacturing went up per capita 1.4% a year, the holders of common stocks gained 16.4% a year. 6 million families, 42% of the total, made less than $1,000 a year. 0.1% of the families at the top received as much income as 42% of the families at the bottom, according to a report of the Brookings Institution. Every year in the 1920s, about 25,000 workers were killed on the job, and 100,000 permanently disabled. 2 million people in New York City lived in tenements condemned as fire traps. The country was full of little industrial towns like Muncie, Indiana, where, according to Robert and Helen Lind, Middletown, the class system was revealed by the time people got up in the morning for 2/3 of the city's families. The father gets up in the dark in winter, eats hastily in the kitchen in the gray dawn, and is at work from 1 hour to 2.25 hours before his children have to be at school. There were enough well-off people to push the others into the background. And with the rich controlling the means of dispensing information, who would tell? Historian Merle Curti observed about the 20s. It was, in fact, only the upper 10% of the population that enjoyed a marked increase in real income. But the protests, which such facts normally have evoked, could not make themselves widely or effectively felt. This was in part the result of the grand strategy of the major political parties. In part it was the result of the fact that almost all the chief avenues to mass opinion were now controlled by large-scale publishing industries. Some writers tried to break through. Theodore Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, Lewis Mumford. F. Scott Fitzgerald, in an article, Echoes of the Jazz Age, said, "It was borrowed time anyway. The whole upper tenth of a nation living with the insouciance of a grand duke and the casualness of chorus girls." He saw ominous signs amid that prosperity, drunkenness, unhappiness, violence. A classmate killed his wife and himself on Long Island. Another tumbled accidentally from a skyscraper in Philadelphia. Another purposely from a skyscraper in New York. One was killed in a speakeasy in Chicago. Another was beaten to death in a speakeasy in New York and crawled home to the Princeton Club to die. Still another had his skull crushed by a maniac's axe in an insane asylum where he was confined. Sinclair Lewis captured the false sense of prosperity, the shallow pleasure of the new gadgets for the middle classes in his novel Babbitt. It was the best of nationally advertised and quantitatively produced alarm clocks, with all modern attachments, including cathedral chime, intermittent alarm, and phosphorescent dial. Babbitt was proud of being awakened by such a rich device. Socially, it was almost as creditable as buying expensive cord tires. He sulkily admitted now that there was no more escape. But he lay and detested the grind of the real estate business, and disliked his family, and disliked himself for disliking them. Women had finally, after long agitation, won the right to vote in 1920, with the passage of the 19th Amendment. But voting was still a middle-class and upper-class activity. Eleanor Flexner, recounting the history of the movement, says the effect of female suffrage was that women have shown the same tendency to divide along orthodox party lines as male voters. Few political figures spoke out for the poor of the 20s. One was Fiorello LaGuardia, a congressman from the District of Poor Immigrants in East Harlem, who ran oddly on both socialist and Republican tickets. In the mid-20s, he was made aware by people in his district of the high price of meat. When LaGuardia asked Secretary of Agriculture William Jardine to investigate the high price of meat, the secretary sent him a pamphlet on how to use meat economically. LaGuardia wrote back, "I asked for help, and you send me a bulletin. The people of New York City cannot feed their children on department bulletins. Your bulletins are of no use to the tenement dweller of this great city. The housewives of New York have been trained by hard experience on the economical use of meat. What we want is the help of your department on the meat profiteers who are keeping the hard-working people of this city from obtaining proper nourishment." During the presidencies of Harding and Coolidge in the 20s, the Secretary of the Treasury was Andrew Mellon, one of the richest men in America. In 1923, Congress was presented with the Mellon Plan, calling for what looked like a general reduction of income taxes, except that the top income brackets would have their tax rates lowered from 50% to 25%, while the lowest income group would have theirs lowered from 4% to 3%. A few congressmen from working-class districts spoke against the bill, like William P. Connery of Massachusetts. "I am not going to have my people, who work in the shoe factories of Lynn, and in the mills in Lawrence, and the leather industry of Peabody, in these days of so-called Republican prosperity, when they are working but 3 days in the week, think that I am in accord with the provisions of this bill. When I see a provision in this Mellon tax bill, which is going to save Mr. Mellon himself $800,000 on his income tax, and his brother $600,000 on his, I cannot give my support." The Mellon Plan passed. In 1928, LaGuardia toured the poorer districts of New York and said, "I confess, I was not prepared for what I actually saw. It seemed almost incredible that such conditions of poverty could really exist." Buried in the general news of prosperity in the 20s were, from time to time, stories of bitter labor struggles. In 1922, coal miners and railroad men went on strike, and Senator Burton Wheeler of Montana, a progressive elected with labor votes, visited the strike area and reported, All day long I have listened to heart-rending stories of women evicted from their homes by the coal companies. I heard pitiful pleas of little children crying for bread. I stood aghast as I heard most amazing stories from men brutally beaten by private policemen. It has been a shocking and nerve-wracking experience. A textile strike in Rhode Island.